For folks who lived through the AIDS pandemic of the 80s and 90s, there's a real sense of dread concerning coronavirus. Republicans failed to take early action on AIDS, and to this day, we're still living with the repercussions of their deliberate negligence. Just like HIV and AIDS, LGBTQ+ people are especially vulnerable to contracting and then dying from coronavirus. Not to get too gloom and doom here, but we have to ask, are we prepared to suffer the same fate as we did with the AIDS crisis?
Today, Dr. Stephen Thrasher, professor of journalism and LGBTQ health at Northwestern University, joins us to look at coronavirus and AIDS, how both of these epidemics impact LGBTQ+ people, incarcerated folks, and rural Americans. Listen as Stephen chats with us about the role ACT UP played in fighting the AIDS epidemic and who we can look to now for leadership in this critical moment when we are all isolated at home.
Plus, why does the coronavirus pandemic not have a ribbon yet, and why is that ribbon green?
Harvey Weinstein is in isolation after testing positive for coronavirus in jail.
And why mental health is still health. How self-isolation brings its own set of unexpected consequences. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Filian.
And this is Feast of Fun.
This is Stephen.
Hi, Stephen. This is Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun. How are you today?
I am well. Nice to talk to you both, meet you both, such as it is.
Yeah, it's how you holding up through the self-isolation?
Okay. I'm actually in, I'm in Brooklyn. And I was here 2 weeks ago to do a presentation to the Ford Foundation, to the Open Society Foundation, and also was supposed to go to the big annual conference on retroviruses and infectious illnesses, which got canceled. And I decided to hunker down here with friends of mine in a brownstone where there's enough room for me to be alone, but I can also dip into their family when I want to. So that's very nice.
Stephen, as a professor and writer who's studied HIV and AIDS history for now over a decade, you must be feeling a profound sense of deja vu right now.
I wouldn't say it's exactly deja vu. I wasn't particularly conscious during the beginning of the AIDS crisis. I was born in 77, so it was part of my childhood, but I certainly wasn't studying it. But there are lots of things that have come up in, you know, the past few weeks and couple of months that very much echo things that I've studied.
What feels familiar in terms of HIV and AIDS history the most?
Initially, kind of thinking about what a virus can do in society, and these are very different viruses, but viruses are these invisible things that, you know, we can only see under microscopes, and that both have these incubation periods where there are no symptoms. And so initially, I was just kind of thinking about how there's this virus moving through the society that is potentially harming a lot of people with coronavirus, novel coronavirus 19, there are many, many more people that potentially could be harmed than HIV because of different ways that they're transmitted. But at the same time, there are very overlapping patterns of who can be harmed the most, because the same kinds of populations are being, in some ways, being made the most vulnerable.
It is interesting that we are seeing a lot in the news about like the celebrities and the politicians that have come down with coronavirus.
Harvey Weinstein, Tom Hanks.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see on the Weinstein. I'm in New York right now. And my initial response, I've been following because I study prison incarcerated populations. And so I've been trying to follow what's happening in Rikers here in New York, also in Cook County, and these places where there are extremely dense concentrations of people and through different means. But I've been thinking about how both populations are, you know, have been at risk historically for HIV. Incarceration is a very strong way that HIV moves, and much more rapidly coronavirus could be moving through these populations. And so that's something that's of concern to me. And yet, at the same time, it's super interesting that Harvey Weinstein is, you know, one of the first people that we're hearing about to get tested, as if there's some kind of magical help that, you know, still comes to celebrities even when they're incarcerated. And Weinstein is an interesting case too, because when he was convicted just a couple weeks ago, he complained of chest pains and was taken to to Bellevue Hospital here in New York. And I don't know. I've been trying to get a handle on, you know, does this ever happen with other people that they can, that they have, you know, they experience a tightening of their chest and symptoms like that, which of course would be a very natural thing to happen after someone's been given a lengthy sentence. And yet I have not heard of, you know, this happening to other people if they wouldn't get taken to the infirmary, but then said they got taken to a hospital. And then very quickly, he's been given this diagnosis. And the actor Tom Hanks, I think it's been really interesting to think about how he was, for a lot of Americans, one of the first faces of HIV they knew from his role in Philadelphia winning the Oscar. He did not have HIV, but he portrayed someone living with HIV. And now he's also come forward as, you know, one of the most public faces of diagnosis out of North America to be diagnosed with this other virus.
Did you see Madonna's Instagram statement where she was naked in her bathtub and she was saying that the good thing and the bad thing about coronavirus is that no one is immune to it? And people were criticizing her because they were pointing out that coronavirus, if you have privilege, if you have wealth, you're more likely to survive this. If you're a younger person, you are more likely to survive this than somebody who is economically or immune system compromised.
Yeah, I think the criticisms are very fair. As someone who studies public health and racial and all kinds of health disparities, racial disparities, disparities around sexuality, I really don't like it when people try to flatten and say we are all at risk, or, you know, we all suffer from the same things, because we don't. You know, there are, we already know with coronavirus, and there's a lot we don't know, but we already know that it targets people with comorbidity, with other things that they're facing. And so there's already kind of an ableist dimension to say that we're all at risk for it. You know, it is true, unlike HIV and certain other diseases, this virus is transmitted so casually that more people are at risk, and the rich may not be able to wall themselves off as much as they would like to. But not everyone shares the risk equally. People who already have health disparities are going to be more at risk. And that tracks racially, that tracks economically, that tracks in terms of sexuality. As someone who studies HIV and AIDS, lots of people living, you know, with HIV have been asking me what their risk is. And we simply don't know entirely, but we do know that you know, people who are taking HIV medications and their viral loads are suppressed, you know, should be as at risk as the rest of us, which is still significantly at risk. But people living with HIV, particularly long term, have often faced any number of other health issues that would put them at increased risk. And LGBTQ people have a wide variety of health disparities, some that are kind of intuitive, some that are very counterintuitive that we don't frankly understand except to know that they exist, that seem to have very little to do, you know, explicitly with sexuality.
Like what?
There are issues around digestion. There's, you know, LGBTQ people are more likely to smoke. Mm. That's one of the things I think we have to look at the most. You know, there's nothing about gay sex, quote unquote, that makes someone more likely to be a smoker. And yet that's true. I have colleagues who are working on things around digestion and the gut, that they're seeing disparities that they don't quite understand, you know, the correlation yet. There are particular health disparities around lesbians and bisexuals that often don't get talked about. Often, you know, and I'm guilty of this too, often, you know, talking kind of about queer health or gay health, it often tracks onto men who have sex with men. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's been a bit more explicit thinking around trans issues, but often lesbians and bisexuals get left out, and lesbians kind of get thrown into HIV, which doesn't affect them at all in the direct same way that it does gay men, but they were very much involved with the politics and the culture around it and the response to it. And so all of these things, I think, you know, we can't just let them get flattened and say that we're all affected the same way. We know that that's not true. And then particularly economically, you know, those of us who have certain kinds of media jobs, I'm a writer and a college professor, I can do the bulk of my work from home, you know, and I have a very, very different situation with how I'm confronting this virus than someone who works as a delivery person or someone who works as a cashier. And we're not, you know, we are all to some degree at risk of, as long as anyone on this planet has this virus, until there's, you know, if and when there's some kind of immunity. You know, we will all be at risk to some degree. Madonna, to some degree, will come in contact with someone who comes into contact with a delivery person. But the delivery, you know, the person who's making deliveries is having far more exposure and far more risk to themselves than Madonna does. So I don't think it's helpful to say that we're all at risk, or we're all at the same risk. We're all in it together. Like, we need to collectively, I think of our society as a living organism that needs to be taken care of and not sort of see ourselves as completely separate from one another. But it's still worth acknowledging that lots of people are bearing the risk the most. And, you know, it's quite obvious when you look at how homeless people, certain service workers, incarcerated people, people who live in very tight conditions, these people are going to be bearing a lot more risk than somebody like Madonna.
Do you think that's why, like, the wealthy oligarchs are kind of breathing almost a sigh of relief or slow to react to this? Like, I'm thinking about someone like Donald Trump or rich Republicans who, by nature of their disdain and contempt for humanity, they're germaphobes.
Yeah.
And so for me, it seems very strange that, understanding that Donald Trump himself is vulnerable to dying from coronavirus, at the very least, a sense of self-preservation would make these oligarchs want to take better, more action, quicker and more thorough, and at least understand that we're all connected in the sense that without Medicare for All, we're very helpless in fighting this pandemic.
Yeah, I think that one would hope self-preservation would kick in, but people act against their, you know, what might seem to be the most obvious form of self-preservation all the time. Trump is an illustration, a manifestation of, I think, a lot of ableist thinking in the United States. And I this is kind of a dynamic I look at a lot of my research, and how we have an ableist sense. Ableism is like racism or sexism, and that certain abilities are privileged. And so the U.S. has a very ableist sense of itself and a very individualistic sense of ourselves. And we generally, and I'm, you know, there are people who act against this, but generally speaking, in the United States, we have an ableist sense of ourselves, that people should be strong enough not to get sick, and that people who are sick are weak in some way. And so I think the president is acting in that way, you know, in a way that is not in particular to him, but of which he is a particularly ugly manifestation. We've seen this when he made fun of the disabled reporter while he was, early in his administration, or maybe actually while he was running for office. You know, we've seen it in the way that he talks about, he's been quoted talking about AIDS, talking about people coming from shithole countries, the way that he initially said people could get through this if they went to work and kind of toughened it out. And that's not unique to him, even though he's very dangerous in the way that he is putting it out in the world. So I think, even for the rich, that they are, I think some part of them thinks they are well enough to get over this and weaker people will not. And so there's less concern about that. And with Trump, I'm not inside of his head, but I think he is enacting both a disdain and also kind of a John Wayne attitude of, yeah, I'm strong enough, this isn't going to hurt me.
You see HIV and AIDS as a prism. I really love that word to describe this condition, and that a sense that it exposes racism, inequality, homophobia, the abuse of incarceration of the incarcerated. It exposes our weaknesses as a society. And do you fear that, in terms of our response to the coronavirus pandemic, that it's going to make things worse, not better?
Do I think that HIV is going to make it worse?
I'm kind of interested because a lot of your research focuses on studying and looking at HIV and AIDS history. And I think actually you're one of the most qualified people that I know personally that can talk about how looking at the past and our history in dealing with the HIV and AIDS pandemic gives us an illustration on what challenges we're going to face with the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so I often look to the writer Zoe Leonard and a quote that she has about AIDS being a prism into the society, and that's what it's been for me. My particular area within that has primarily been the criminalization of HIV and AIDS, but AIDS has become a way that when I think about it and its history and the politics around it, it helps me understand policing in America. It helps me understand lots of things about the United States, and so I think there is a lot that we can learn. It's not a perfect mirror of what's happening now, but understanding how HIV and AIDS came into the United States, came to be a part of our history, and how it still exists in our present, I think give us some really interesting roadmaps about how to navigate what's happening now. And with HIV and AIDS, it was also a virus, and its harms were exacerbated by an inactive Republican administration. The forces behind that inaction were related but distinct. I think a lot of them had to do with homophobia, and with also being despising of people who use drugs. But they were also, like the current crisis, I think, and the Trump administration, they both exist within frames of disability and despising people who are disabled, and also within frames of austerity. That often the reason why you can't treat viruses, particularly in their early stages, is given because it doesn't matter who's harming, and also because there's not the money for it. And I've been studying this in my most recent research, how HIV criminalization and policing interact here in the United States. But more recently, I've been looking at similar dynamics in Athens in Greece in a very different context, where HIV rates were actually getting quite low about 10 years ago in Athens, very, very low, where the major form of transmission is IV drug use. And there were very, very innovative, not particularly expensive, but very, very innovative and robust ways of interrupting transmission with IV drug use by clean needle exchanges and outreach on the streets. And then when their economic crash came, they cut that funding and the HIV raids shot way, way, way up. And it's really interesting. There are about 300 counties in the U.S. where there are similarly no, there's really no kind of infrastructure to deal with HIV. There's no sex education. There's no gay sex education. And there's no, there's also very, very little outreach around IV drug use and needle exchange and such. And so when HIV hits in these counties, it can actually move very, very quickly, the same way it did in Athens, because there's no infrastructure in the first place. And the shared reason is austerity. And so I think we're seeing a lot of that now with coronavirus as well. The places it's exploding are the poorest places, you know, the places of most dispossession, prisons, places like that. And I was just reading this morning about how Louisiana has one of the highest, if not the highest, confirmed rates of coronavirus in the world, in a way that doesn't surprise me because it has super high rates of HIV, also because of economic disparity, systemic racism, lack of access to medical care, and being a population that politicians consider disposable.
Mm. And the needle exchange, they cut it for austerity, but in the long run, it saves much money, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, that's one of the most ridiculous things. It wasn't particularly expensive in the first place. And, you know, Athens went from their increase of rates of HIV infection increased 3,000%, I believe, over 4 years because of these programs being closed. So it ends up becoming an extremely expensive thing to deal with. But austerity is the reason that's given in the first place for not paying for it. And it really, you know, it doesn't make any sense. If we had put a lot of money into masks, PPE, into testing and all these kinds of things in the U.S., it would have been profoundly less expensive. But we're seeing, you know, than the fallout that's happening now. But what we're seeing is a similar dynamic in that who's going to pay? And the ruling class is trying to make the people with the most disposable bodies pay, that we pay with our lives, that we pay with our health, and also that we pay in debt, that these things aren't paid for, that people go into, you know, individual arrears, they become beholden to the banks. And it's a very, very different political calculation than saying the state is going to pay or the state is going to marshal resources in the beginning. But usually what tends to happen is the landlords still get paid, the debt servicers still get paid, you know, whether or not who's paying for it. And yeah, it would be cheaper overall, but I think the ruling class often bets that if someone's going to pay, it's actually going to be, you know, the poorest and most dispossessed.
In the 2014 HIV outbreak in Indiana, Governor Mike Pence's reaction to that exasperated it. And it's somewhat tragic and horrifying that he is now the person in charge of the federal government's response to the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, that's true. Governor Pence Vice President Pence was the governor of Indiana during this outbreak in Scott County. And his initial response was to pray about it. And that was, of course, very concerning to public health scholars. He took a few days to do so before he put in a needle exchange, which was very limited and came with the threat of incarceration. And so that, of course, drove a lot of people from even using it in the first place. And colleagues of mine, Greg Gonsalves and Forrest Crawford at the Yale School of Public Health, did really interesting research kind of looking into what happened if Pence had said something sooner, you know, kind of looking at the dynamics from that moment. What they found was that it was still Pence's fault, but actually not so much for that reason, but really because he had, even more so, because he had gotten rid of the health infrastructure that would have dealt with it sooner. They had closed the only clinic that did HIV testing in the southern half of the state years before. And so I think we kind of have to broaden our frame out when we look at the clowns that are running this right now, which are really messing it up in lots of ways right now. But it's actually, you know, this is kind of the end point of what they've been doing. They've been dismantling the social safety net for years. They've been dismantling the need to do prevention work. Certainly, they've been dismantling anything that deals with the economic fallout from this and that would give people a chance to protect themselves more. And a concept I've been kind of trying to think about more generally, which I was just reading about this morning, is the U.S. economically really tries to cut it to the bone to save costs on everything, including on the costs of warehousing and shipping and things like that. That's part of the reason why we don't have any masks, because we've sort of gotten to the place where we like to think we're not going to make anything until the exact second that we need it, and then it will be manufactured. But a lot of that manufacturing happens in China and depends on supply lines from different countries. And it also, when you're saying things are going to be expensive or more, the rich have not wanted to be taxed in any way that would cost any money to leave supplies and things at the ready for this. So when the disaster strikes, there's actually not the infrastructure and the material tools available to address things rapidly as they need to be.
Trump canceled the domestic manufacturing of coronavirus supplies, masks, and sanitizers, and moved it overseas, and now continues to resist local production because of big business lobbying him. Anything that you could do wrong in order to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, it has been done. And very similar to Ronald Reagan's reaction to the HIV and AIDS pandemic, was anything that he could do wrong, he did. Oligarchs are going to oppress. That's their kind of what their job is going to do. Haters are going to hate, you know? But what drives me a little bit concerned is someone like Hillary Clinton, when she was running for president, was praising someone like Nancy Reagan for her response to the AIDS crisis. And it, to me, it also makes me look at the leadership of a lot of healthcare and advocacy groups of gay men's health programs and LGBTQ advocacy programs and HIV programs. A lot of them are arguing against Medicare for All, or they're aligning themselves politically with leadership that is against Medicare for All. Biden, being one of them, is a very vocal opponent of that. And to me, I'm just kind of wondering, why are these people thinking in this way?
Yeah, it's really concerning. I wrote a pretty angry column the night Hillary praised Nancy Reagan. I think in retrospect, she probably, it was something of a mistake in an uninformed staffer briefing her. But more importantly, she and Joe Biden and a lot of the Democratic establishment and very worryingly, a lot of formal LGBTQ politics, or I'd actually say more formal gay politics than LGBTQ, have become, as you've said, they've become proponents of private health care. And I kind of started to think about this, and you know, it does ultimately speak to where we are with coronavirus, but I started thinking about this in 2012, I would say, when I was covering Occupy Wall Street for the Village Voice. I was in Zuccotti Park one night with Bill Dobbs, who was an old-time ACT UP activist. He was running the library, he was staffing the library table at Zuccotti Park. And we were talking about how none of the formal gay groups had been at Occupy. There were lots of queer people there. There were lots of queer people participating, but none of the gay, you know, organizations were there. And they couldn't be because so many of them, they were all sponsored by the banks, Goldman Sachs, you know.
What kind of groups are you specifically thinking about? Human Rights Campaign?
Human Rights Campaign, but, you know, even the AIDS groups, GMHC, the Empire State Pride Agenda, none of them formally could offer any vocal support for Occupy Wall Street because their sponsors were the exact banks that were being targeted by Occupy Wall Street. And that got me to, and Dobbs was the first one to point out to me, which I've since documented in quite detail in my dissertation, going through the Active Oral History Project, that AIDS activists wanted universal health care. They wanted Medicare for All. They saw it as a form or something like Medicare for All. They wanted to detach health care from employment and from relationships, because of course back then there were, you know, queer people who were married to straight people for their insurance. Mm-hmm. But they thought that if we could detangle these things, not only would it untie people from certain kinds of relationships, but it would allow creatives to say they wanted to try something new or something politically radical, and without having to, you know, be terrified they'd lose their health care if they did that. So I started kind of thinking about it then, and Dobbs also pointed out to me that during the early Obama years, when the Democrats were trying to figure out how to expand healthcare insurance, none of the, you know, LGBT groups, none of the AIDS groups were even pushing for something like Medicare for All. And so that's when I like started to realize that a lot of formal gay politics from the time of ACT UP had abandoned the idea that everyone should have health insurance, but it moved to something much more targeted. They had moved towards expanding health insurance through marriage and fighting for same-sex marriage, fighting for the recognition of marriage relationships by law, and or if, you know, in states where it wasn't happening by law, to encourage big employers to do it. And so, of course, in a way, there's nothing wrong with wanting to expand health insurance that way, but it leaves lots of people out because it presumed that people would get health insurance by coupling up in a particular way with someone who had a high-paying job that was going to offer employee health insurance. As we've seen just in the past weeks, with 10, 20, 30% unemployment coming, that's not going to protect anybody who loses their job. I was at a conference once where the scholar David Eng talked about marriage is kind of a neoliberal offloading of insurance, right? Like it's saying, if you're gay, the state doesn't have to provide you health insurance. You should kind of figure that out privately to figure out someone to marry and to get it through their job in a private way. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing. And it's dismaying because there's a great amount of queer politics around Bernie Sanders that I think would have and, you know, could potentially still bring a lot of good to people, but a lot of the formal gay politics that circled around Hillary, that are circling around Joe Biden now, are dominated by gays with links to those banks and who are going to argue against Medicare for All because they want to concentrate the power amongst a handful of corporations.
I wonder if it's even part of like somebody's job description. I have an acquaintance who works for an HIV AIDS advocacy group, and almost everything on his Facebook update is something, slamming Bernie Sanders, pro Biden or pro Elizabeth Warren,
threatening people,
so against Medicaid for all. And I'm just kind of like, don't you have a job to do? Like, you're on every single thread that I see. And eventually I just had to like, I'm like, I'm going to snooze you, maybe come back. And then I snooze them, and I come back 30 days later and it's still the same kind of thing. Are we seeing the big pharmaceutical companies? Are we seeing the Wall Streets just like, are they pumping so much money into these kinds of organizations like they did with HRC that kind of like was just like, we're endorsing Hillary Clinton before, you know, we even got anywhere with that primary?
Yeah, I think that's
and
some
what
of what
can
we're
do.
Yeah. I mean, we can just speak our truth and speak about our experiences. In many over the past 6 months, the Sanders campaign was winning the majority of LGBTQ people because we do have health disparities and we have economic disparities that, of course, mean that we would want his policies the most. And it's been super interesting. It's confusing to me in a way that the healthcare guy is not running, that people are not wanting him in this obvious healthcare crisis, but that speaks to bigger issues in the country. But LGBTQ people would really benefit from the programs that Bernie was pushing for, which were not means tested, which don't require lots of red tape. Bernie wanted college for all, and that's something, as a college professor, I know would benefit LGBTQ students a lot because many are, they can't come out, or they're scared of coming out, or they're scared of expressing their gender identity expression because college education, strangely, beyond any plans people are putting right now, it so is dependent upon parents. Young people turn 18 years old, they can be drafted to the military and sent off to die, but they still have to ask their parents to sign off on their FAFSA forms, and they're expected to try to get their health insurance until they're 26. So it gives them this kind of, their parents are sort of infantilizing power over them until they're 26, while they're having to pay taxes and can be sent off to war to die and all of that.
And then their parents complain that their kids haven't grown up when they turn 26.
Right. Right. And so, like, I understand why, queer people have moved towards policies like Sanders. But at the same time, as you're articulating, the Warren and much more so the Biden campaign were very good about bringing in bringing in gay people to speak for them. And there's this weird cycle that happens between pharma and Wall Street and gay rights that pharma sort of presents itself as being benevolent to gay people. The biggest quote-unquote donor to HIV causes in the United States is Gilead. Gilead is also the biggest drug manufacturer of HIV medications. And the reason it is, a quote-unquote donor is because it is so effective at lobbying to keep its taxes low, and it uses its quote donations as a way to basically buy political cover. And it's been, you're talking about your friend on the Facebook thread. I have seen, in really sad ways, I was on a panel with someone like this recently, where Gilead and these places, like, they give money to community groups and to community organizers, and they don't have to force them to do anything because the people feel guilty and beholden to them, so they will defend them. When in fact, like, everyone's health would be a lot better if these companies made their products into generics and let everyone have access to them, and didn't literally lead to the reason why people have health disparities and die earlier than they need to, because they can't afford these outrageously expensive drugs.
How does not having Medicare for all impact the United States' ability to fight the coronavirus pandemic?
There are a couple of ways, and it's going to be interesting to see how England fares, because England has the creaking and ailing, but still has the National Health Service. And so that's going to be an interesting case study between the two. But we don't have one system in the U.S. We have multiple competing, we have 50 different states with 50 different sets of regulations and also territories. And they're all competing against each other. And then there are, thousands, if not tens of thousands of different insurance plans. So they're all fighting against each other. There's no coordination. The prices are being driven up because the federal government has not enacted the production tactics it could have to make a unified system. Medicare pays a lot less for drugs than anyone else because they buy them in bulk and they organize the payment for them at the scale of the entire United States. Right now, we probably have 50 different states all trying to buy the same respirators and the same respirator manufacturers trying to sell them to the highest bidder, which is a very, very dangerous and expensive thing that would not be happening if the federal government were to say, we're commandeering plants to make respirators, or we're buying respirators from one place and distributing them to the 50 states.
But one argument that, I would call it Democrats or centrist Democrats are making against Medicare for All is they're saying, look at the incompetency of the Republican Party and the Trump administration. We cannot trust Trump. And now we want the government to have a monopoly on our health care. What do you say to that?
And one of the things that's dangerous right now is doing things during a fire makes them more dangerous. You know, if we had a healthcare infrastructure that was existing for a long time, it would not be as dangerous as trying to throw it together at the last second. And there are still health disparities in countries with centralized systems, but they're not nearly as extreme as they are here. And if we had one system, we would be making sure that everyone, potentially was getting treated. When everyone pays into a system and people can't buy their way out of it, then the system actually is forced to be better. You want a system of, like, I am very for college for all and not making billionaires pay for it, because if the system is good enough that billionaires' children still want to go, then it's going to be, like, good for everyone.
And conversely, also, if it's not good, the billionaires are going to put a lot of pressure on the system to make it better.
Right. They're not going to think they can just buy their way out.
And I think in a lot of progressive countries like Norway, for example, a lot of wealthy people and a lot of people from modest backgrounds share dormitories together. They go to classes together. They socialize together. So it's very difficult to think of poor people as this, undesirable part of your population when you personally know them, and vice versa.
Right.
It humanizes the population.
It does. And coming back to HIV as my prism through looking through things, is I've certainly seen in testing, there are all these barriers around getting people tested for HIV. Criminalization is a barrier. Stigma is a very high barrier. Costs are barriers. If people know that they can go get tested and it's not going to bankrupt them, that is a huge way to drive down the barriers to getting people tested. So as long as people are terrified of what it's going to cost, that's going to make them less likely to get tested. If they think it's going to destroy them economically, they're going to keep going. They're not going to get tested. And I saw this kind of something parallel. I moved to a new insurance carrier when I started my job at Northwestern. And I thought I had, I chose the most expensive plan because I thought that would help inure me to future costs. But I got a chest x-ray before all this happened, in early January. And it was several hundred dollars. And, I would think twice about getting a chest
x-ray. With insurance.
With insurance, with like the most expensive plan I could have.
Now, if you were in France, for example, and that happened, what would you pay for something like that?
I don't think you would pay anything in France. But even in most countries with central systems, it's a set fee regardless of what it is. And in the US, you have no idea what it's going to be. Right. It could be, even with your insurance, thinking you're doing everything right, it'll cost you a lot. So as long as that's the case, that's going to be a huge driver away from people getting tested. And even with the woefully incomplete attempts to get people tested, there's also pretty explicit direction that that's not going to cover coverage, that people are probably going to, could still very well get bankrupt if they need any kind of coverage. So that suppresses down who's going to actually get tested. And that, of course, has the most impact on the most vulnerable in society. But coming back to your point about, what will affect everyone, that's going to leave them still making deliveries and working as store clerks and
coughing
such.
Coughing on your food.
and coughing
on your hamburgers,
which is nothing. There's nothing ethically or morally wrong about them trying to survive. That we're all subjected to these forces, and to pretend like the economic forces don't exist is really illogical and unhelpful.
It seems like every couple months I read on Facebook, like somebody in our community, a drag queen somewhere, was sick and just, you know, didn't go to the hospital, probably because she's broke. And then the next thing we know that she, you know, she's in intensive care and then she's dead. And yeah. I often think that if she had just been able to go to an urgent care, which might be $50 or $75, maybe they'd still be around. But if she were in a country where we had Medicare for all, this person who's, you know, provided hours of entertainment for people would still be around.
Yeah.
There's a lot of controversy right now on the internet about self-isolation. And you've written about this, that, you know, mental health is still a form of health, and self-isolation, or the drive to isolating ourselves for 2 weeks or months or even a year, may bring its own set of problems as well.
Yeah, it's very true. My first worry about self-isolation, or even just isolation, was thinking about domestic violence, which has already been spiking. Mm-hmm. My first thought of hearing people get sent home, as a queer person, as someone who studies queer life, I know that the assumption that home is the safest place is false. It's the site of the most sexual and physical violence, particularly for women, often for queer people. ER doctors I follow are already saying they're seeing an alarming increase in child abuse and violence against women. So that is my first worry. My second worry was, which true epidemiologists can explain this better than I can, but I understand the value of social distancing. It keeps people away from each other. It can and should flatten the curve. But at the same time, we're basically putting people into a containment unit where we're asking them to stay there until someone gets so sick they need hospitalization. And in a way, the metaphor, I'm sure everyone's seen the matches, and you pull the one match out and it stops all the matches from lighting. But another analogy, I think, is it's like everyone's being put into a fire holding cell. And so the fire may burn up everybody in that cell, even though the wall will keep it from going to the next cell, which is what we need for society. But it's quite concerning to think we're sending everyone home. We're not testing. There's not mass testing. We're not getting a good sense of antibody tests over who's already been exposed. And so it's really putting the risk on individuals to just sort of wait it out, which is a very different approach than South Korea had, for example, where they did isolate people, but they also had massive testing with these drive-through testing places so that people could find out where they stood. And then there's also, and this would be hard to do at scale, but there's one town in Italy of 3,000 people where they literally tested all 3,000 people. And when they did that, they found out who the handful of people who were actually infected. They isolated within their homes as well, because people are not, isolating within their homes from each other. And that bore the best fruit. And so I'm concerned about what it means to just send people at home without much testing. And then there is the mental health issue. And for someone like me, I'm very lucky. I'm staying with friends for now. We have a containment unit in this house. But I live alone. I've lived alone for 15 years. At some point, as this is going on, I will return to my own apartment and live alone entirely. And it's really, I think, going to be very hard for people who live alone, are not touched, don't have anyone to have sex with except themselves or virtually on cam, who are expected to forego all the things that happen in terms of socializing because they don't have those happening inside of a kind of idealized home. And I think that we really have to be attuned to that. We have to be attuned to depression. I've been starting to get reports from gay men that I talk to that this is having a deleterious effect on meth usage, and ways that people have been able to find sustenance and recovery in community is having a really deleterious effect now that they're alone. And so we can't pretend like these things don't, are not part of our health. And also just socializing with people on some kind of basis, of course, that gives us all kinds of public health benefits that we're losing right now, checking in with people, seeing how people are doing. And so I'm not in any way saying that we don't need to self-isolate, But we rapidly need testing to be ramped up to make the sacrifice, because it's going to be a big sacrifice. And we rapidly need to be figuring out ways to address physical and domestic violence, because that is going to be a huge problem for a lot of, particularly women and children and queer people.
Do you think that people are going to be demoralized in, you know, a month after self-isolation and the Trump administration still hasn't gotten enough tests?
I think so. I mean, everyone's sort of, I think we're all adjusting to what this new reality is, and it takes time to do that. Behavioral change takes time and effort. And so I think it's actually, I don't think it's a bad thing that people are first looking at 2 weeks and then thinking about what if this goes on for months, because it's hard to take it all in. But I think they will be demoralized. And we're also as social animals. We are adapting. I think people are figuring out how to socialize using technology tools and how to support one another through mutual aid networks. But certain things are going to get more difficult over time. And I had a nightmare that my iPhone broke. And on the one hand, you know, I don't like to idealize sort of this expensive capitalist thing, but at the same time, it's like, this is the portal through which I have to do everything, including socialize. And I can't go to the Apple store to get it fixed. And you know, it made me think of the Twilight Zone episode where there's a nuclear fallout and the man's, you know, excited to read and his glasses break. Like, we have, like, people's glasses are going to break, their hearing aids are going to break, their iPhones are going to break, and, you know, like, things are going to happen that are going to start making life more difficult over time that are not, you know, to be written off. Like, these are things that are going to have to get figured out. And I think it's worth acknowledging that, you know, which is, again, like, not to say people shouldn't do it, but I think it's worth acknowledging what we are doing right now is a sacrifice, and we need to make sure that the sacrifice is worthwhile and that it has, you know, is limited. We need to have a harm reduction approach to limiting the amount of pain and death that it's going to cause individuals as this goes on.
I mean, in some ways, this is like a religious right-wing abstinence proponent's wet dream come true, is because, you know, in the 80s, at the height of the AIDS crisis, it was, you know, do your duty and wear condoms. Now it's do your duty and abstain from talking to anybody. Pray at home, you know. I mean, what more isolation can you ask of society? And I'm starting to get, I mean, we're just 1 week into all this, and I'm starting to see a lot of people that I know personally, anecdotally, just getting cabin fever. And they're like, I notice a lot of drag queens and cabaret artists and comedians wanting to do group shows in their homes, and then arguments happening over why this is such a bad idea in the first place.
Yeah, it's really tough. This is sort of unprecedented in our time. Never in human history have you been able to, I've talked to friends on four continents, five continents now, you know, and we're all going through more or less the same thing. This has never been true in human history. And yet we can't go through that with each other physically. And it's very difficult. And I think, you know, for queer people, we have a particular responsibility to each other, and an advantage, because we're already, I think, community minded more than necessarily the imagined straight American family, which of course has lots of variation within it too. But you know, we're really charged with taking care of each other and not, and I had a friend who was like trying to talk one of those drag show get-togethers from happening and trying to do it. Like here, I think we can actually go back to lessons from the early days of AIDS, like knowing shame doesn't work, you know, just kind of shaming people doesn't work, and yet having to enforce, reinforce positive behavioral change in a way that's not going to drive people away. And while acknowledging the really strong need to connect with other people and to try to think of different ways to do it. I
what do you make of those kids that went to spring break, or Republicans who are still in denial over the coronavirus pandemic, and they're like having, you know, group barbecues and parks and, you know, going to Daytona Beach in Florida, and they're like, if I got coronavirus, so what? I do what I want. Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm more upset with Republican leadership than anyone else. I understand that it feels good to look at other groups of people and think they're stupid. It feels good to look down on them.
Well, that's not
why you become a professor, right?
Right.
But what else are we going to do on social media?
No, but while I became a professor, a social scientist anyway, I think is though to stand back and say it still doesn't work from a public health messaging standpoint. Like, there's nothing. It doesn't matter how righteous the cause is. Mm-hmm. Like, is smoking, safe sex, any of it, you know, regardless of the context. Like, shaming people just is not an effective tool. And I think, you know, and I've taken some heat online from this, and I'm happy to take it and to, you know, talk to people more about it. But I actually, to pretend like the young people going to spring break or people going to bars or restaurants, to act that we're all individuals alone making these decisions as if economic forces don't play a role, as if the economic force to drive customers and workers into open restaurants or to drive, you know, people onto beaches or into parks. Like, they're not alone. These forces exist, and pretending as if everyone just has to kind of magically do the quote unquote right thing is unrealistic. It doesn't make sense sociologically. You can actually affect much more behavioral change by having the leaders who should be in conversation with the scientists closing the venues or making sure those workers are going to get paid if they don't go to work, and kind of shutting down the gravitational pull of these places than only saying it's the people. And we know that, you know, I've been just trying to kind of think gently and realistically about this, is that people have a sense. They don't have much of a sense of danger until it's upon them. So, you know, you can say to people, the whole human race is going to die if you don't stop doing this thing. It's not always the most helpful argument, but you could make it. But there are huge swaths of the population that, you know, that know that no one's ever cared about them in the first place. Homeless people have no motivating factor to change their behavior, one, when they don't have a home, and two, when no one's really cared whether they live or die before. And I think about, you know, how often I travel a lot, or did. I don't know that I ever will again, or any of us will, but, you know, I travel very frequently by plane for research, for work, and also for vacation. And, you know, my plane flights cause people to have worse asthma. It causes the climate to, you know, be more likely to have bad effects in the future. And I haven't modified my behavior that much. I don't drive a car. I do other things to try to keep my footprint low. But, you know, I certainly engage in behaviors that I know for my own benefit are going to have ill benefits for others. And so to, like, kind of assume everyone's going to be on the same page of the 7 billion earthlings right now is, it's going to take people a little bit of time to get there. So that's kind of how I think about each population adjusting its behavior, because they keep doing it. You look around the world, mm-hmm. You see people don't take the warning for week one. They start doing week two. You know, when it becomes more apparent in week three, they do more so. And it's part of human. It's just part of being human that behavioral changes are difficult to do. And I'm actually quite impressed at how quickly people are modifying their behavior.
Well, I mean, I was just like thinking about going to the gym, and all the gyms are closed. And it's like, for a lot of people, just their mental and physical well-being, even though they don't catch coronavirus, is at risk. And I'm thinking, you know, if you had a heart attack, or if you had you're on dialysis, or, you know, people who have any kind of health issues right now, going to a hospital is a big challenge. One thing that I thought was really interesting, you were talking about how even the test for the coronavirus itself isn't really fully addressing this issue, that we should be testing for antibodies as well.
Yeah, and I'm trying to learn more about that. It's actually some of my reading I'm doing this afternoon. But in the United States, we have very little. We've had very little testing. We're getting more, but the most common test is telling you, do you have this in your body right now? Yes or no. It doesn't tell us if you had it before. And if we knew who had it before, it would give us a sense of how wide the spread has happened. It would also, which there, and this science I don't I can't really speak to it, but it would point to us starting to, you know, be able to say, are people building up an immunity or not? Like, there's no test for that at all. And we don't know. Like, we don't know if people have been exposed, if they're immune afterwards through different strains. That's all very not understood yet. But there are tests available that can see if the antibodies have been in your body, which would at least, like, let us say, okay, you know, is this population, you know, one out of 1,000 have it, but, you know, 10 have already been exposed. So that would start to give some sense of where the rates are going and how well the population is surviving it. But we're quite blind right now in that. We're just getting, is the person in front of me positive, yes or no? And I think that that's lulling some people into a sense of, you know, Trump is like, when Trump allegedly tested negative, and that's something I won't, you know, won't trust them on, you know, but when Trump allegedly tests negative, that doesn't mean he couldn't be positive tomorrow or the day after that. But I think that, like, part of our sense in these things are like, whoo, this person is negative or I'm negative, when actually we need to know, like, well, were you exposed and does previous exposure mean anything? And if there was an immunity building up to previous exposure, that itself would have to get studied extensively to find out how much is it binary. It's not, you know, how much likely protection is that going to give you? You know, can those people be counted upon? Like, can healthcare workers have already been exposed? Should they be the ones that are staffed to do certain things because they have more immunity built up?
And we have none of that info yet. If you do get a virus, typically you do get some kind of immunity to it, right? Because your body will recognize it next time it comes into your body, right?
Usually, yes. Mm-hmm.
But it can also not, you know, it's not just because the virus entered your body, your immune system may not have recognized it and may have flushed it out just through the natural process of your body.
Right. And then there's also, you know, like anyone who's, when you have tetanus or, you know, or certain inoculations, like they last for a period of time, right? And so we know that, like, we know so little about this virus. We don't, we know that it wasn't, as far as we know, it wasn't in humans, you know, before a few months ago. So once you see it, we have some sense of the time, but, and this, I'm making this entirely up. I'm just saying this is a hypothetical. You know, it could be that you're exposed to it and then you're immune for a number of months or a number of years or a number of weeks. Like, we have no idea. If you're immune at all, we still don't know yet. But until we start doing antibody tests, we're not even going to have a sense of who has been, you know, exposed. And then, you know, and if someone was theoretically had the antibodies in their system and did, you know, then got sick later, then we would know, oh, it's, you know, we still have to be very careful. But we just don't have any of that information yet.
It seems like every pandemic since, or healthcare crisis since the AIDS crisis has had like some kind of ribbon. You know, with AIDS, we had the red ribbon. The coronavirus, I haven't seen a ribbon yet, but is it going to be green? What's the color going to be of the coronavirus ribbon?
Sadly, I don't, like, we're not going to see the ribbon because nobody can get together. Nobody can get together to wear it. Yeah. I mean, like these ribbons you would see show up, you know, at award shows and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So, we're arguing about the color. I said it should be green because, like, when you write virus on your iPhone, virus comes up as green.
But is that on every platform, or is that just the iOS versus Android?
And I think also it's interesting that, you know, it's some of the stuff that I've read about you, speaking about how ACT UP, you know, really kind of got the dialogue moving and pushed the needle forward on HIV and AIDS. But their techniques are markedly different and not necessarily can be applied to what's going on now because we can't gather in groups because of the self-isolation.
Yeah, I call that the ACT UP conundrum because they're so powerful in bodies in space. They do have, ACT UP has a very good social media presence that has actually done a lot of good around raising issues around Gilead, the company that controls most of the HIV medication in the U.S. and that also seems to be the fastest on track towards coronavirus medication. So we should look to their history of dealing with this. But a lot of their history is, you know, around the use of physical bodies, I'm watching and listening to and trying to learn really from disabled activists right now, because disability activists are used to figuring out ways to protest without necessarily being able to physically put their bodies, you know, in place. And I think that's going to be a really important thing for us to look at. But the, you know, the ACT UP conundrum, I think, you know, it speaks to bigger fears I have about society as a whole and the ways of keeping people basically in home incarceration and keeping us separated from each other, that does leave a lot of room for political authoritarianism. And if we can be kept apart, if all of our, you know, as I wrote about in my piece, if all of our interactions are now through Zoom, from going to class to having work meetings to, you know, having virtual sex parties or drag shows or whatever mm-hmm. happens, if all of this stuff is happening in these spaces that are conceived of public commons, because we have to go to them to gather, but they're privately controlled, that gives a lot of power to the tech platforms and to the information, you know, that they're sharing with the state. So I'm very kind of concerned about how ACT UP is a good example of kind of thinking about what we lose when we lose the right to assemble, but also what does it mean more broadly that we can't assemble physically, and or that our ways of assembling are all going to happen on these private digital platforms. And I thought I kind of wrote about this in a related way with different stakes when Tumblr actually banned porn a year and a half ago or so. Mm-hmm. And I had become quite interested. There were so many queer and sexual communities that were just not replicable once that ban happened. Like, there were people who had particular sexual tastes that had gathered in communities of dozens or hundreds or thousands that there was just no way to kind of move them somewhere else. And that was a bit of a canary in the coal mine, I thought, of seeing how internet power was going to want something quote unquote clean, family friendly for major platforms, akin to what happens on Facebook in terms of nudity and whatnot. And a lot of the tech defense of their standards is like, well, you know, you can choose to use this or not, but you know, people really can't. You can choose not to be on Facebook, but you pay a huge toll financially and professionally in terms of what opportunities are available to you in life, you know, if you don't use these things. And now K-12 public schools have no choice, you know, but to use Zoom and what their standards may be. And, you know, there are conservatives now calling to record all the classes of college professors like me so mm-hmm. they can try to find something that
and you also work in the sexuality department as well at Northwestern, right? So you guys are no stranger to the media discussing what you guys do there, right?
No, and
fuck saw.
Yeah. in my appointment in the Institute of Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Wellbeing, it's primarily research oriented, so we're happy to talk to the media about it. And I was going to teach it, and virtually, I guess I am still, teach a journalism class that was going to happen inside this institute, but I'm very mindful. I talk about sensitive things in my own life, about race. You know, so often people talk about race get hounded by Fox News and places like that. Sure. But I'm also really mindful of, and I feel very protective of and honored that, you know, I've often had students be able to talk in my classes about very personal matters, about their own sexuality, their own understanding of themselves racially in society, their own experiences of gender expression. And I feel very sad if they feel like they can't talk about that, or they're like worried about that being recorded. You know, they might want to say something to me and their peers that they feel safe saying in that group, which doesn't mean that they want that recorded and potentially used again, you know, used online or by an employer someday.
Sure.
And so I'm like super mindful of what having all of our interactions now from, you know, ACT UP meetings or political meetings or, you know, classes, all on these private platforms. It gives me a lot of concern.
Let me ask you this. So I walked my dog today towards the lakefront, and I'm walking down Bryn Mawr, and I see about four or five police cars. They come running by. And so I cross the street because I don't want to interrupt what's going on there. I want a social distance, but I also don't want to walk by all these cop cars. And I see from across, you know, I'm walking down the street, and I see an attendant from the CTA, you know, and she's looking across the street, kind of like, and she's looking very concerned because we see like these young men who've got their arms up against this building and all these cop cars going around. And there was, you know, there was some tension in the air. And she kind of looked at me. I said, what did these guys do? Did they cough on someone? And she burst out laughing. And so, you know, and I just kind of kept on walking because it's like, you know, I don't know what was going on there. But then I got thinking, it's like, and then they had this, you know, this guy in Kentucky who tested positive for the coronavirus and was like, I'm not changing my lifestyle at all. And he had the police surround his house and basically make sure that he stayed inside. I guess he did eventually become compliant. But since you study the intersection of, you know, prisons and prison reform and health and stuff, do you think we're going to be seeing some things like that? Are people going to be sent to jail or being, you know, what are you afraid is going to happen? Or what do you think might happen?
Yeah, so I study HIV criminalization, and I've been studying the case of Michael Johnson, the Tiger Mandingo case, for 6 years. There was a young man, almost 7 years, I guess now, who got arrested for HIV transmission and initially sentenced to 30 years in prison because of our reporting at BuzzFeed. He ended up being able to get his sentence overturned and getting more legal help and eventually was able to get out of prison about 25 years early, but he spent the bulk of his 20s in prison. And what I found from that case was that criminalizing disease just never works. It doesn't work from any angle. One of the easiest ways to understand, I think, how it harms the public health is that when diagnoses can lead to criminal action, it suppresses people getting tested. So, because you can usually only be arrested or prosecuted or harmed by the law if you know that you have this disease. So the HIV prevention people that I know who do work in this area immediately saw a downturn in people getting tested, because if you didn't know you had HIV, you couldn't be prosecuted for it. And to see someone be prosecuted and sent, in essence, you know, sentenced almost to life in prison is incredibly scary. It makes people not want to know that they have HIV. It makes it all the more stigmatized. Mm. And I think with there's just nothing good about having the, you know, the criminal justice part of it to any public health campaign. Here in New York State, they're not using the Governor Cuomo's directive so far, have not called for individual fines. Some in California have. Other places in the world are more draconian. There was an arrest that happened in one jurisdiction in Canada. And in Chicago, as I understood it, it's not in the statute, but when Mayor Lightfoot, or in the Illinois statute, it didn't seem to be, but Mayor Lightfoot said her initial press conference that the Chicago Police Department, you know, would be helping enforce that, which I thought the CPD is like, you're going to cough and they're going to shoot you. You know, like the CPD has no business saying who is, you know, sick and who is not. They should not be diagnostic agents. But one of the other problems, which I think is, if I'm remembering the Chicago, I've been looking at so many of these, I'm not sure, but if I'm remembering the Illinois statute, it was saying, you know, if you've been sick, you're not supposed to leave. And that is also shares characteristics with the HIV stuff, in that so much of the transmission happens asymptomatically that I think it creates bad thinking about, you know, about how to stop onward transmission. So in Chicago or New York City, like these dense cities, we should actually all assume that we are either living with the, you know, with coronavirus, or we've been exposed to it. Like, it calls for universal precaution. And HIV, again, history helps well. Because of an HIV, doctors wear gloves. Like, doctors and dental hygienists and people like that didn't wear gloves before the 1980s. EMTs did not wear gloves. They all wear them now, specifically. And there are all kinds of other benefits from that, too, by the way. But, you know, the reason why they do is because they assume everyone is HIV positive, even though it only affects, I would say, it varies with populations, but well below 1% of the population generally in the U.S. is affected by HIV. But they wear gloves. They're supposed to wear gloves 100% of the time when doing that. And I think that with coronavirus, we should be acting in the same way. And the idea that you would use the police to sort of concentrate and scapegoat those who look sick creates bad thinking, bad practices. It increases stigma. It makes it even harder for people to have open, helpful conversations about how to, you know, address this crisis. And I think it's more helpful to, you know, to think of our community as a single body, as much as possible, not to think it's you or me and you're sick and I'm well, which creates all kinds of antagonism, but to think about how do we keep our whole body safe and well, and, you know, even amongst the sick cells and the well cells. And it's much easier to like pile on or to use the police to say there's a scapegoat, that's the problem. That might feel good, and that's easier. It's cheaper, or it's at least short-term cheaper than saying, yeah, actually, we should pay for everyone to get a test. It's much easier to say.
So is Madonna right then? We're all in this together. That we're not.
She's right in that we're all in it together. Yeah. No, I mean, she's right in that we're all in it together. But again, I still think it's disingenuous to say we don't all have the same level of risk. Like, and the police tend to actually go after the people with the highest risk, right? Like, imagine the kind of people the Chicago Police Department are going to be seeing if they're sick or well. Like, they might not go after you with your dog. Particularly if you're not coughing, but they might go after the Chinese food delivery person who has allergies and is sneezing, you know, from the trees. Mm. That's the kind of person that's going to end up in the crosshairs of the police. So they are still bearing much more risk, even though, like, we all need each other to be well to make sure the whole body is well.
Stephen, thank you so much for your service. I know this is usually something reserved for somebody who is in the front lines of a war, but in a lot of ways, the work that you're doing is so critical at such a delicate time in our society, in our history, and it's something that I see very few people doing, and people that have been in the role that you've been in, are in, have been compromised by the immense amounts of money from the pharmaceutical industry. So I don't know if Gilead's tried to write you a check and you said no. But, you know, I really appreciate you advocating for, as Bernie Sanders, let's go fight somebody for somebody we don't know.
Well, thank you. Your words are very meaningful to me, and I appreciate them.
You know, Ari, what can people do in the meantime? Besides, I know that right now, when there is a huge crisis like this, a lot of human privacy freedoms are usually rolled back. We saw that during September 11th. People can definitely call the representatives, write letters, and you know, ask them to be extra vigilant in this time, because, you know, like, the coronavirus relief package is causing, you know, the Republicans are going to do what they're going to do. Oligarchs are going to oppress, haters are going to hate, and we need to be even more vigilant in fighting those forces. What else can we do?
The first thing to do in any crisis, including this one, is to understand people are already doing the work and to not think we have to reinvent the wheel. So, you know, to understand there are people who have been doing work around disease and disability. And when we get upset about seeing cases popping up in Cook County Jail or Rikers, that we can understand there are people who have already been organizing around this stuff. And so to support them first, I think that it's really important to look at, as we are physically constrained, you know, to look at the leads of disability activists who already have all kinds of infrastructure for how to communicate, you know, without physical mobility. So that's like kind of the first thing. And then also within our own minds, I think it's really important to think about the survival of the community. We are socialized in the United States to think about my survival first. Do I have enough food? Do I have a mask? When I was trying to understand the issue with masks, and I did after, I'm forgetting the author's name, but there was a good piece in the Times last week about how we all should be wearing masks if we had them, but we don't. So they're going, you know, we need to get them to first responders first.
Well, you can make some with a t-shirt and a sewing machine at home. Like there's all these videos on YouTube. The biggest problem is the elastic bands are nowhere to be found.
Yeah. And it doesn't work as well with straight cloth and with other kinds of cloth, but some protection can
help. You need that four-way stretch.
You know, but the issue actually isn't because the masks don't protect you as much. I mean, there are other masks that do protect the people, but the general mask we're talking about actually doesn't protect you as much. It's protecting other people from your spittle, from your respiratory droplets. So it's actually less like we shouldn't think about how do I get a mask, but actually we want to think about how does everyone have a mask, because that would protect us from each other. And I think that we want to keep oriented our thinking about how do we survive, you know, not just do I have enough food, batteries and toilet paper, but like, does everyone on my block have these things? Because if I don't have them, I might have extra toilet paper I can share with someone else, or they might have extra food they can share with me. And so I think the best thing people can do is tie themselves into formal and informal mutual aid networks that are not just their family, that can spread the risk and the resources amongst communities. And then I think, which I'm working on writing a piece about this now, we can really think about the language that we use and not blaming each other. I am encouraging people not to like write about the patient zero in a community. One, because that was false. When Randy Schultz used that term, he just didn't understand that. So the patient O he was referring to as patient letter O for outside of California. And that somehow became the myth that was patient zero, as if the first one. But heaping scorn on people for engaging in normative human activities. I feel the same way about HIV. People get HIV through normative human activities. They have sex without a barrier, which there would be no human race if people didn't have sex without a barrier. You know, they do any number of things that are just normal. And with COVID, people are doing things that are normal. That someone is sick does not mean that they're bad. That someone didn't know they were sick and went somewhere. You know, we shouldn't think of them as like the problem that brought this disease into a new community. The problem is that we're not getting a large-scale coordinated state effort. And so I would say, you know, don't use language like this person got me sick or they brought this thing into this, you know, otherwise clean place. Like direct your anger at our political leaders, which need a very coordinated mass effort of testing and an economic relief program so that we can protect ourselves and each other in the long run.
So should we be tweeting or using hashtags on Instagram? I mean, part of it is like, you know, I've noticed this with Facebook and social media giants is that the most progressive candidates, Warren and Sanders, were both saying these are monopolies that will be broken up if I become president.
Yes.
And so they responded by increasing their efforts to push conservative ideas onto progressives. And one thing I've observed is a lot of people that I know who have a history of advocating for queer health and equality are advocating against Medicare for All. And the second thing I've observing on social media is divisive content, is seeing people that are natural allies with each other arguing over minor points. And that is because our attention is being drawn into the people we know.
Yeah. So one thing I think is important, which we've seen with Bernie Sanders' campaign, his continued campaign, is not to give up on ideas just because they seem like they're not winning right now. I think a general American propensity is to say, you're a loser, be quiet. So like we need to keep talking about things that we think are important, even if they're not being talked about in this news cycle. Social media is a great way to connect with other people, but I think it's super important right now to also to connect with your neighbors, however you do that, you know, whether you're putting a sign up in the neighborhood we can still use tech to do it, but, you know, with an email list, if you're figuring out how to connect with other people in your block, because we want to have ways that we know how to help each other that are not simply virtual with people that might have great geographic distance around us, but we also need to be connected in some ways to the people around us, particularly as supplies, resources, or experiences are not available to everyone. You know, if you know someone is going to be, you know, hospitalized or something. They live alone. They need someone to take care of their dog. Like, we need to know those kinds of things about our neighbors. And so I trying to tap into ways that we can support each other pretty hyper-locally. I think that's something that people can do at this time.
Stephen, thank you so much for everything you do. And I want to leave people here. My sister said this in Spanish, but it's la única cura que tiene esta enfermedad es la solidaridad. The only cure this disease has is solidarity.
I love that.
From a distance.
From a distance. We'll get through this. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all you're doing, too.
Thank you, Stephen. Welcome. I appreciate that. I hope you can come back sometime, maybe in the home studio if things change.
We'll make you some cookies.
I would love that.
Take care, Stephen.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Dr. Stephen Thrasher is a writer and professor at Northwestern University. He's chronicled HIV in America for about a decade now, and you can follow him on Twitter at ThrasherXY. And we'll put up a link on the show notes here on the podcast. And so for you guys to follow Stephen, because we really just scratched the surface.
Mm-hmm. And he's got a lot of articles, a lot of interviews out there. He does a lot of talking on these subjects, and you know, which are very important to us, especially at this point in time in our history.
What do you make about people's reaction to being self-quarantined? Is the tension is being turned up to 11, and I'm seeing people like they're more impatient with each other. I feel, you know, like I work in customer service, or I used to work in customer service, and now I'm kind of like using those skills to manage a lot of the angry people that I'm dealing with on social media. And I'm just like, my reaction is, I know this is difficult. I know this is hard. I thank you so much for your patience. Thank you for trying this experiment that we're going through in social isolation. I promise you that if, you know, in a month we don't see the Trump administration taking any kind of action, that we won't be so socially isolated, you know. And part of it is like when Americans start to seeing that Republicans are not stepping up to the plate, then things are going to get a lot more intense. And that means people will be leaving their houses, and this may things may actually get worse as a consequence. But we're not going to just sit down and die quietly in our homes because some oligarch got greedy during a pandemic. Not this time around.
Yeah.
You know, we are learning from our past, and we are going to change our actions, you know. And I'm also very deeply grateful for the activists that, regardless of where they are today, those activists who did contribute to making the world a better place, to helping alleviate the HIV and AIDS crisis in the past, even though they may have been compromised by large sums of money from pharmaceutical industries. At one point in time in their history, they were very progressive. They were very grassroots oriented, and they advocated for people. You guys can listen to the archives of many of these activists who may not necessarily agree with themselves in the past. On our archives at feastoffun.com/plus.
I want to do a shout out to Nashom Wooden, who is former drag star Mona Foote from New York City, has died from the coronavirus. He left drag a few years ago, but, you know, people remember him as that drag queen. And he also worked at the Cock in New York City out of drag. So he was very much a vital part of the New York City drag scene. And, you know, it's unfortunate they got the coronavirus and died.
Mona Foote also shared a very close relationship with RuPaul back mm-hmm. in the early days.
She said she learned some of her makeup techniques from RuPaul.
Interesting. The good ones or the bad ones?
Well, you can look at some of her photos and stuff.
You can definitely see the influence.
And see for yourself of what that's like. And there's lots of photos, especially around today, of her dressed as Wonder Woman.
So, oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Rest in peace.
Honey, I feel like we're on a roller coaster, and we mm-hmm. still haven't gotten to the top of the hill yet. It's like true. That tension that mm-hmm. keeps building up as the goes, you know, going up mm-hmm. and up and up and up on the roller coaster. And you're like, how much more are we going to keep going before we get that first big drop? Mm-hmm. And, you know, honey, we're still not gotten to the top of that hill. No.
And I want to reach out to people. And, you know, if you are feeling isolated socially, call your friends, call your family, talk to people, leave messages, you know, write to us even, whatever you need to do. And if you're in isolation and you don't feel safe because of domestic violence or anything like that, there are resources out there, domestic violence hotlines that you can reach out to. And if somebody's beating on you or doing something like that, make sure you call the police, because a lot of times it's the person that calls the police first that gets to stay in the home. I'd also like to remind people, too, that I'm not sure if this number is still the same, but it was a few years ago, that 60% of new HIV infections usually come from somebody who's your primary partner. So maybe you guys have, you know, been playing around, doing whatever, and then you're socially isolated and you're not on PrEP or any kind of HIV regime. And then you decide, well, you know, we're here alone, let's just do it. That could be a prime opportunity for HIV transmission. So, you know, practice safer sex even during the quarantine.
And harm reduction means giving yourself permission to make mistakes. And I'm noticing a lot of people who are in recovery relapsing on and talking about it on social media, mm-hmm. chastising themselves severely because they people who are not drinking alcohol or not smoking meth or not smoking cigarettes or whatever it is that you are trying to remove from your life, they've turned back into those mm-hmm. things. And, you know, relapsing is a part of the sobriety process. It is part of that journey. It's a difficult journey to take. It is not easy. Not everyone struggles in the same way. And, you know, forgive yourself. You can make mistakes during this. It's okay to take a nap. It's okay to do nothing. Doing nothing is doing something. Mm-hmm. And if you feel like you have the energy.
You're saving lives by doing nothing.
I think I saw one study that said for every 5 days that you stay at home, you're saving up to 400 people's lives.
Mm.
And like Stephen was pointing out, you know, this is an experiment. We don't know if this approach, alongside a very incompetent administration, is going to result in something where we can go back and forth in the world. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you this, honey, once the coast is clear, it's going to be like The Wiz. Mm-hmm. Can you feel a brand new day? I mean, it's going to be like the Pride Parade that you had always dreamed and read about, but you never experienced. It's going to be everywhere. People mm-hmm. are going to be out in the streets. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the thing, too, is that, you know, these oligarchs, these fascists, these monsters are terrified. They're feeling so empowered right now, seeing everybody kind of like, you know, isolated and at home. They're thinking this is the time for them to pass all these horrible legislations. I think Liz Winstead was saying that in some states they've suspended all abortions for women. And which is causing all kinds of other pandemics, all other kinds of problems, healthcare problems for women. Mm. And, you know, this is something that is very serious. And please, if you have the time, if you have the wherewithal, it doesn't hurt just to tweet or Facebook message, write a letter, just say, hey, I thank you for being vigilant about human rights and the right to privacy and the right to healthcare. And, you know, even Biden, wherever he is,
he's coming out of his hold.
I hope he's coming out of his hold because we need Biden. Even you may not like Biden or you may not like Trump or you may not like Bernie Sanders, but we need all these politicians' leadership and we need to put pressure on all of them, including Bernie Sanders, to fight for you, right? Fight for your health, fight for your well-being. Because, honey, we got to stick together and fight this thing. And this is the defining moment of your life. So you are being called to action.
Get with it.
Get with it, honey.
I would
Come on, girls. Who's with me?
I want to remind folks we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus or make a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate.
Honey, because this is right now our sole source of income right now. And we thank you guys so much for all the contributions that you guys have done. I know for some people, it's a huge sacrifice and we are very grateful. We promise to do right by you and continue doing this podcast as long as we can, as long as we have funding to do it. So FISA Fund is made possible because of generous support of people like you. For people who listen to the free show, that is has a few ads. Those ads cover the cost of hosting that program available free to the general public. If you want an ad-free experience, you can go to patreon.com/feastofun or feastofun.com/plus, whichever you prefer. Some people don't like Patreon. Some people don't like PayPal. You can become a member and support Feast of Fun. We're one of the few podcasts that are putting out content right now. A lot of these celebrities, they're like at home going, hey, how do I work this thing? I don't even know how to turn on the computer. I don't know how to run a phone.
But we got it going on.
We're still here, baby. And we are going to do it. I'll be like that guy with a mask in the Mad Max movie, Iron Bar. You know, he was like hard to kill. They kept on pushing him off the train and throwing a bucket of mud in his face. And you thought he was left for dead. And he just kept coming back. And that is me, honey. I'm gonna come after this with a vengeance.
You get it, girl.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.